in fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned.
Now it is not only a huge day in the Harwood universe, because it is Palms Sunday. That's right, Palms Sunday. And I have some big news to break to you guys about Jack Palms and Young Junius. But I am so pumped to have my boy, Scott Sigler, on the podcast this week. That's right. Scott doesn't always do crime fiction, but we have a couple stories from him that we're going to do this week and next week around an awesome event that he has going on his website around his publication of the book, The Starter, the second book in the GFL Rookie Starter Galactic Football League series. Now, this is awesome. Why? Because the way that Sigler has pioneered the publishing model of the Rookie and the Starter is what gave me the idea for this new partnership that I have with Tyrus Books. I'm going to tell you more about that at the end of the episode. I'm going to tell you all about what Scott's going on with the Starter this week when it launches live at his website, scottsigler.com, on Thursday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. But get over to scottsigler.com and get your copy of The Starter pre-ordered, because I am, and because that thing is banging. You can use the code Seth, S-E-T-H, to get $3 off of your purchase there. Do it. Love it. Reason being, Scott's great, and we have to support the podcasting authors. Scott is the one who taught me how to podcast. He's the other co-founder of Author Bootcamp along with me. And if you've never listened to a Scott Sigler podcast before, get ready for a treat. When you're done with this, head over to scottsigler.com, where you can get all kinds of stories there. He's got about 6 novels that he's podcasted. You can find them in Borders, Barnes & Noble, all around, but also for free on his site as podcasts. Scott is podcasting all the time, and he is nothing short of awesome. Literally. I give it all up for Scott Sigler, and you know he's my boy. So, he's going to give us this story, Kissy Man and Jesse Dupree. I'll be back at the end of the episode with a little bit of news from Tyrus Books, some stuff from me for Palm Sunday, and that's right, there's an episode on my website today, SethHarwood.com, where you can get brand new news about a new Jack Palms short story that's coming your way. No news about it here. Get over to SethHarwood.com and listen to that new Hot Tub Cast. Bring it, son! Let's get this story. By the way, Scott Sigler, podcasting legend. None of these free stories, no Seth Harwood hitting Jack Wakes Up onto the top of the Amazon charts, none of it. So let's give thanks to our boy and listen to this great piece.
Here we go with Kissy Man and Screaming Jesse Dupree. Hope you guys enjoy the story.
Kissy Man, is that a roll of quarters in your pocket, or are you just glad to see me?
Her fingertips traced my inner thigh, delicately moving across the rigid hardness clearly visible beneath my suit pants. I wasn't the least bit turned on, of course, and her coy question was truer than she knew. She gave me her best eye flutter and slightly parted her red lips, letting me see the wet, inviting tongue inside. I imagine what a stunner she'd been before getting hooked on smack. She did her bleach blonde hair like the other Jane Mansfield pretenders, but a few stray strands escaped the hairspray hell, and her makeup wasn't quite right. The deep, smoky shadows of Club Miscellaneous hid the dark circles under her eyes, the track marks on her inner arms, and the pallor of her alabaster skin. In here, in the faint twitching light from a candle flickering on the cozy booth's tiny table, amidst the drone of an awful swing band that tried and failed to be, as the Americans say, jumping, she was her old beautiful self again. My left arm draped around her shoulder, holding her close. So what that she'd probably taken at least 8 guys into the back room already that night, making a paltry 16 bits per John. A girl has to work, right? "Now I am glad to see you, my sweet," I said, smiling my most genuine smile. "But little kissy man points straight up. That really is a roll of quarters in my pocket." She looked momentarily confused. "That is a roll of quarters, but you, Fräulein, you get the dimes." I twisted in my seat and pulled her head down towards the table. I hit her with a short uppercut right that connected under her chin. I basically had her in a headlock, so her head didn't fling back from the blow. Instead, it sagged forward, weak and limp, with her sudden bout of unconsciousness. I held her up with my left arm, which remained about her bony shoulders. I opened up my right hand. The roll of dimes was intact. The paper hadn't broken. I slid the roll into the pocket of my overcoat, where it met its friends. A roll of pennies, a roll of silver dollars, and a roll of nickels. I like to keep spare change for every occasion. I lifted her out of the booth, effortlessly using one arm to hold up her wasted 95-pound body. She used to be something, my sources tell me, but thanks to heroin and thanks to screaming Jesse Dupree, she'd become less than nothing. I moved her towards the front door of Club Miscellaneous. Her loosely swinging head gave the impression of a severely bombed but still functional woman. I hoped it was enough to get me out the door without any more trouble. Norman, the bouncer with no last name, at least not one he ever mentioned, saw me and Cassandra moving through the smoky darkness towards the door. Rumor had it Norman used to work the whaling boats of Nova Scotia. He perpetually whittled a piece of scrimshaw, which enforced the whaling reputation, although I suspect that he only carved so he could keep a knife in his hand at all times. In Club Miscellaneous, a handy blade was the mark of a wise man. He set the small piece of whalebone on the bar top and slid off the stool. He always stayed close to the door. It only took him a few huge steps to block my path. The scrimshaw knife remained concealed in his huge, gnarled hand.
"Hey, you going somewheres with Cassie?"
I'm a big man, but Norman had at least 3 inches and 35 pounds on me.
"Me and the lady here are going back to my place. We're going to boogie-woogie till we can't walk, big man."
"You want a boogie, you go to the back room. Cassie's a working girl. She don't leave the place. Besides, she looks like she's had one too many."
I kept smiling and moved my free hand towards my coat pocket. Several bar patrons turned to watch the scene, finding it infinitely more entertaining than the swing band that treated Little Brown Jug the way a drunken man treats a redheaded stepson. I love American music, but hate undisciplined American musicians.
"Norman, do you know who I am?"
I asked it pleasantly enough. I'm no saint. I'll tell that to anyone who asks. But I do like to give people a chance before I do a blitzkrieg on their face. Norman hadn't done anything to me. He was only doing his job. If I could get out of here without spilling his yellow, poorly spaced teeth all over the beer-soaked floor, well, then that was all for the best.
"Don't know who you are, and I don't care. Now get into the back room before I decides to whittle on one of your finger bones."
"Ah," I said.
Conflict appeared inevitable. As always, I felt myself start to giggle. That's the other thing I wish I could get rid of, so much more than my German accent.
"Well, since you put it that way..."
I pretended to stumble. I let Cassandra fall forward, limp and lifeless, towards Norman. My performance wasn't Oscar caliber, but then again, Norman wasn't exactly a critic for the City Daily. The big bouncer automatically reached out to catch the frail Cassandra, dropping the scrimshaw blade as he did. My left hand slid into my pants pocket. Out popped the roll of quarters, wrapped tightly inside my fist. Recognition flashed in his eyes as her feather-light body fell into his hands, but it flashed a moment too late. I brought down a big roundhouse left on Norman's jaw, just under his ear. The crack was audible even over the trombone player's big off-key solo. Norman fell back on his ass, hand on his jaw, eyes blinking with glassy confusion.
Not enough to finish you, eh? Big boy!
By then I was laughing so hard he probably couldn't understand a word. I reached into my coat pocket and pulled out a roll of silver dollars. Wrapping my knuckles around the heavy coins, I delivered a swinging, underhanded right into Norman's mouth. Kind of looked like I was throwing strikes down at the 10-pin lanes. The blast rocked the big man's head and sent him sprawling on his back.
I like it.
I stared down at Norman's staring at the blood pouring from his mouth. Two bloody, yellow teeth lay on the floor next to his head. He had ugly teeth anyway.
You're an expensive date, Norman.
I just couldn't quit giggling. I opened my fist. The roll of silver dollars had split open. I lost my smile. Cursing to myself, I let the loose coins fall to Norman's chest. Most of them rolled off and clattered on the beer-soaked wood floor. I picked up Cassandra, tossed her effortlessly over one shoulder, then walked out of Club Miscellaneous. That laughing thing seems to be my trademark. That and the kiss. That's why someone tagged me Kissy Man. They don't know my real name, and I'm trying to forget it. I'm trying to forget a lot of things. Hell, everything. That happened before I came to America. When I beat or I kill a man, I laugh. A lot. People think I'm a psychopath, but that's not the case. It's just funny is all. I don't know why I do the kiss. I've been doing that laughing thing since the war. You know you've got a problem when even your comrades in the SS think you're sick. They'd have kicked me out, but Der Fuhrer needed every man on the job. And, of course, the German army wasn't exactly known for its humane treatment. My hysterical laughing went largely ignored as long as I kept killing people. The more I killed and tortured, the funnier it became. Things changed for me when they stationed me at Dachau. It was supposed to be downtime for me, a break after 3 months of nonstop intelligence and commando missions. I believed Hitler's speeches and policies until I saw that place. Sure, we knew the Jews were relocated, but believe it or not, most Germans had no idea of what went on in those places. I was SS, was an Übermann, part of the master race. Little things like concentration camps weren't supposed to bother me. But it did bother me. It's one thing to fight hand-to-hand with strong American boys, track down and kill the blood-crazed terrorists of the French Resistance, or drive a knife into some Polish trooper's gut. Those men were soldiers. They fought for something they believed in, something they were ready to kill for, possibly die for. They were just like me. Well, only they didn't laugh as much. It was another thing entirely to see the Jews and the gypsies of Dachau. These people weren't soldiers, and most of them couldn't fight if their families' lives depended on it. They were dying skeletons, lost souls who watched their wives, husbands, friends, and children die every day, either from starvation, disease, or a swift blow from the butt of a rifle. The soldiers never used bullets. We weren't allowed to waste ammunition on Jews. I only lasted a week in Dachau. I met this little Jewish man named Hillel Chapman. He offered me a deal. He must have been a great judge in character. Not to mention, he had balls like bulls, as the Americans say. Perhaps Hillel saw something in my eyes each time a trainload of Jews or Czechs or gypsies came in and were sent off to the gas chamber. He had to know. because I could have killed him for what he offered. A bag of jewelry. Jewelry was the coin of the realm in those days. A man with good jewelry could book passage on any ocean liner or work his way through the underground of any city. He'd collected it, somehow, while inside Dachau. Many Jews slipped family treasures inside, usually by swallowing them over and over to keep them from the guards. Hillel gathered these treasures until he had enough to offer. I never asked how he got them from the others. They really didn't want to know. I can't say what's worse. German guards treating Jews like animals, or Hillel Chapman preying on his own kind. He was a focused man, still is, and he'd have done anything to escape that place. I can't say I blame him for the things he did to stay alive. Hillel wanted me to bust him out. He said there would be more gold for me if I took him to America and acted as his bodyguard. Imagine the courage it took a wrinkled-up old Jew to pitch that deal to me, a decorated SS colonel. Maybe it was just desperation. But either way, I said yes. I'd have taken any way out of there if I could, and if it had to be risking my life for one small Jewish man, so be it. I broke him out. That's an impossible feat for an inmate, but easy for an SS officer. I mean, who would expect an SS officer to bust a Jew out of camp? I simply came for him one night and walked him to the front gate under the premise that I was taking him into the woods to torture him, and I didn't want to wake anyone. Believe it or not, that was simple courtesy in the SS. The camp commander sent two guards with me for my protection. I knew them both. They were good men. After we walked into the woods, I killed both the guards. That sounds cold, but after you've killed your first 60 or 70 people, it's no big deal. I used my knife to keep things quiet. As I sliced each of their throats, I laughed and giggled. Maybe that's what keeps me from going mad. Maybe I already was mad. For some reason, I kissed each of the dead men. Maybe because I knew them. I mean, who knows? Kissed them goodbye. I've been doing that ever since, and I still don't know why. It was easy to get Hillel to America. Late in the war, disorganization was the rule in Germany. A man with an SS uniform could travel just about anywhere by slipping a bribe here and there. We wound up in Turkey. I ditched the uniform, and we used the last of Hillel's treasure to book passage to America. I considered myself lucky that I only had to kill 5 men during the trip from Dachau to the big, beautiful American city. Hillel came through in his deal. He gave me $10,000. I was lucky, because he could have killed me. Little Hillel Chapman turned out to be a major player in the Jewish mafia of the city. He was high up with the Freedmen organization. They were low profile, and they played it smart, but they were just as vicious as the rest of the gangland types that made the city streets run red with blood. He gave me my money, but I couldn't exactly go to work for him. A nice, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, former SS officer working for the Freedmen's just wouldn't float. The 10 grand didn't last all that long. I'd been a soldier all my life. I knew no other trades or skills. But you know what? The tricks I'd picked up hunting down the French terrorists, well, that translated well to the city. Now, I'm paid to do all kinds of things. Find people, find things, deliver messages, you name it. I'm also paid to kill people. Which is why I had to find Screaming Jesse Dupree. I took Cassandra to Leroy's Hotel in New Harlem. It's a bad place for me to be. Most of the residents don't take kindly to white people. But I got a reputation for hiring black men when I need more muscle. And I pay very well. That simple fact buys me relatively safe passage through the area. Kind of like to think that old Adolf rolls over in his grave each time I work side by side with a Schwarze. Our room had a bed with dirty sheets, an incessantly dripping stand-up porcelain sink stained with spots of yellow, a small nightstand, and a single naked bulb that didn't fully illuminate the small room. "Wake up, Cassandra," I lightly patted her cheek. She lay on the bed, on top of the dirty sheets. Her eyes fluttered open. A look of confusion hung on her face. quickly replaced by a mask of agony. Her hands tenderly held her mouth, and tears streamed down her face.
"I broke your jaw. My apologies."
I pulled a sheet of paper and a pen from my inner coat pocket and threw them on the bed.
"I hope you know how to write. I only use dimes. You have the glass jaw, yes?"
Cassandra looked through her wavy eyes, staring at the room. It was a cheap place that smelled of gin, vomit, and urine.
"Where is Jesse Dupree?"
Cassandra started to ask for help, but even that basic plea sent torrents of agony cascading up her face. She cried out instinctively, which only compounded the pain. Her eyes screwed shut with misery, and she fought to suppress her moans. I kicked the bed once to get her attention.
"Where is Jesse Dupree?"
Cassandra looked up at me with pleading eyes, as if to beg for release from this torment. She should have known better. I was only getting warmed up.
"I'm going to ask you one more time, Fräulein. I suggest you put away the tears. If you think you hurt now, you are in for a surprise."
I reached into my pocket and pulled out a roll of pennies. I let her see the roll and made it disappear inside my fist. Cassandra all but dove for the pencil and paper. Her tears dripped onto the page as she wrote in a furious, panic scrawl. She turned it around so I could read it. "Don't know," the paper said.
"Oh, you are his favorite girl. You and he put those needles in your arms and then swing, yes? That's how he stole you from Madame Sarah. That's why you're a cheap whore now, yes?"
More tears poured down Cassandra's cheeks. Maybe it was more than physical pain. She was very afraid. Unlike Norman, Cassandra knew my reputation. She started to shake. I didn't know if it was from fear or because she needed a fix. She bent her head to write again, tears lightly dripping on the paper with an audible pitter-pat. She wrote, "He'll kill me."
"I'll protect you, I promise."
She wrote, "Need a fix, can't think."
"Oh, is that all?"
I reached into my other coat pocket and started setting items on the bed. A syringe, a plastic bag filled with white powder, a spoon, a candle, and some matches. She stared at it the way a starving man stares at a chocolate bar. Almost of its own volition, her hand scrawled madly across the tear-soaked paper. She wrote, 1178 Court.
"This address had better be right."
She scrawled, "You won't tell him I told you?"
"Well, I might tell him, but not to worry. He won't be alive long enough to do anything about it."
She wrote, "You'll protect me from his men?"
"Protect you? Well, yes, I did say I'd protect you, didn't I?"
I reached into my shoulder holster and pulled out a cheap .38, special fitted with a silencer and wrapped in cloth tape. Cassandra shook her head no, adrenaline blasting through her body, the pain of her jaw momentarily forgotten. I pointed the gun at her. I knew what I had to do to cover my trail. I was going to kill Jesse Dupree after all, and he had powerful, vengeful friends. If I let Cassandra live, word might get out. The only way to protect myself was to kill her. I cocked the hammer, but made the mistake of looking into her eyes. They were empty of all but fear. Hungry eyes, eyes without hope. They reminded me of the eyes that constantly watch from behind the fences of Dachau. In reality, she was the same as those poor souls, trapped in a concentration camp made from needles instead of barbed wire. I lowered the gun.
"Call Madame Sarah. She wants to help you, or at least try. I've paid for the room for the whole night."
I didn't say anything else. I should have warned her not to talk about me. But what good would it do? Some other piece of muscle might break her jaw again someday, and eventually, she'd talk. I knew I was making a big mistake, but I left anyways. I was headed for Court Street. Before I left New Harlem, I stopped by Easy's place. an after-hours club. The club didn't advertise, didn't have a sign. The entrance was a simple door covered with scratched red paint. It sat in the wall of a warehouse covered with a massive chip painting advertising Archon cigars. If you didn't know where the place was, you didn't belong anyway. I walked in and wasn't surprised to be the only white man in the place. I'd been to Easy's more times than I can count, and I'm still the only white person I've ever seen in there. Well, you know, the only one who leaves alive. Even the Galone family won't come in the place, and everyone knows how crazy their soldiers are. All eyes locked on me as soon as I walked in. The place was dark and full of dark-skinned people. I stood out like a pale candle in a lightless room. People had learned not to bother me. There's a lot of tough, dangerous men in the city, especially New Harlem. But there were a lot of tough men in the war, too. My safety resides in the fact that when threatened or accosted, I don't even bother to think. I just kill. Death is a language of respect spoken everywhere in the world. I moved to the back of Easy's place, where Blind Willie always sat with a deck of cards, a cup of coffee, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. As far as I knew, he slept and ate there. He only left to do a job. Hopefully, I'd have him leaving soon.
Hello, Willie.
He was neither blind nor named Willie, but that's what he liked to be called. He was a dangerous, talented man, and I respected him. If he wanted to be called the Great Zucchini Fucker, I'd have called him that, too.
Well, if it isn't the Master Race.
It's funny, but amongst the two groups of people, Jews and blacks, who should have hated me for what I was, I found limited acceptance. It was the whites, especially the Italians, who hated my guts for being German.
What are you doing here, white boy?
He produced a second shot glass and poured me some whiskey. That meant Willie wanted you to sit and talk. So I sat.
I'm looking for a hired hand for the night.
He took a sip of his steaming coffee.
So you come look for some poor nigga to do your work for you.
Willie always had something to say regarding the relationships between whites and blacks. I ignored it. I always found it funny that so many Americans fought against us in the war because we were genocidal. The ultimate racists, as they say. And yet America is full of racial hatred so thick you could float a body on it. I learned long ago this is a land of contrast and hypocrisy. Americans. Who can figure them out?
It pays $500. I'll take anybody who can keep his mouth shut, but I would rather have you.
Second story worker, just plain muscle.
I thought it was funny he referred to himself as muscle. He weighed all of 150 pounds and stood 5'6". He was tiny, but I'd seen him use a knife and a gun. He was deadly fast with the former and perfectly accurate with the latter.
I think it's both.
For five bills, I'm assuming it's heavy work.
I'm taking out Jesse Dupree.
Man, that's crazy, Fritz.
He said that, but he smiled. Screaming Jesse Dupree ran his own racket. He often raided black bootlegging efforts. If Willie killed him, the 500 would be a drop in the bucket compared to the respect and admiration he'd get from the Jolson gang. Not to mention the $2,000 they offered for Jesse's head. Black gangsters don't get a lot of press in the city, but they are very bad news.
And I assume you know what crazy Jesse is. Nobody can find that Georgia cracker anywhere.
I know where he is. I'm going there now. If you're in, meet me at the corner of Court and Heidelman in 1 hour.
I stood and walked for the door. I didn't need to look around to know that all eyes watched me as I left. Court Street is up in the Heights, the high-rent part of town, home to doctors, lawyers, captains of industry, and thugs who've climbed crime's company ladder and want to posture amongst the city's ruling class. There's not a lot of houses up in the Heights, but each one is worth a fortune, and each one comes complete with high stone walls, big iron gates, and men with guns. Willie was at court in Heidelman right on time. He showed up dressed in all black. His skin was dark brown, the shade of a chocolate-colored suit, but it wasn't shiny, and he faded into the night like a drop of dry ink on black canvas. My lily-white skin reflected each streetlight, and my face stood out like an alley cat's eyes during full moon. To counter that, I'd also dressed in all black and covered my exposed skin with blackface.
Gee, Willie said when he saw me. You look a lot better this way, Fritz. Once you go black, you never go back.
He laughed, but I didn't understand his humor. I rarely do. I handed him a Thompson submachine gun. All surfaces were covered with black cloth tape to protect against fingerprints. I carried the same kind of weapon. He smiled as he slung the weapon over his shoulder. He pulled a long coil of black rope from the car and slung it over his other shoulder. The starless, moonless night matched our attire. Street lamps lit up the pavement, but behind their illuminating cones, the night claimed all light, all detail. We didn't know the layout of Jesse's place, nor did we have time to figure it out. Madam Sarah wanted him dead. If Jesse left this place, it might not find him again. Willie scaled the 8-foot wall like it was nothing more than a child's toy truck he might step over without thinking. I'm a highly trained commando, but Willie moves so smoothly, he makes me look like a rank recruit. He swung half over the wall, then helped me up. We dropped to the ground inside the wall, motionless. Not much lighting on the grounds. Jesse never stayed in one place for long, so he'd probably rented it. He hadn't bothered installing the lighting needed for proper security. Sweeping the grounds, I counted at least 10 men carrying Tommy guns. Another 4 guarded the front of the sprawling Victorian mansion.
We tangle with those boys. We ain't leaving here, Fritz, Willie said.
I nodded.
Can you get us to the second floor?
Willie huffed, as if I'd insulted him.
We moved along the wall towards the house. I watched for the guards' patrol paths. They were lazy, repeating the same steps, looking at the ground and smoking cigarettes that wrecked their night vision. I wondered how Jesse had survived so long with guards like these. Willie spotted an easy way into the second story via a vine-covered veranda built over a glass-walled porch. One guard stood atop the veranda. He was smoking a cigar and staring off into the night. We moved closer, taking our time and quietly slipping through the lazy perimeter guards. I didn't like leaving armed men behind me, but I couldn't kill everybody and still get to Jesse. I pulled a throwing knife from my belt and took careful aim. I threw the knife just as the veranda guard turned to face us. It hit him dead center in the throat. The man gurgled, but fell without making any serious noise.
Damn,
Willie whispered admiringly as we silently sprinted for the veranda. He threw a fabric-wrapped rappelling hook on the veranda without even breaking stride. It landed with a muffled thud and caught immediately on the stone railing. Willie sent me up first and he followed, expertly collecting the rope behind him as he climbed. We spilled over the stone rail. The guard's blood spread across the marble tile, looking like black water in the night air. The veranda led into a bedroom. We slipped inside, grateful to find the room empty. Willie pulled a knife as long as his forearm, the flat painted black, so that only the edge glinted. I pulled a silenced Luger, a weapon that felt as familiar as an old lover's body. Willie looked at me for suggestions. I signaled for him to be quiet and listen. One thing I'd counted on was Jesse Dupree's mouth. How the man stayed hidden for so long is a mystery to me. His normal conversational tone is a shout for any other man, and when he actually yells, it's like a panzer driving through a brick wall. We listened for a few seconds. That was all it took to pin him down. Jesse was yelling into the phone, or perhaps that was his conversational phone voice, I can't be sure, but we heard him far down the hall. We exited the bedroom into a well-lit hallway, lined with striped velvet wallpaper, Victorian couches, and gilded mirrors. It reminded me of the fancy French villas the SS loved to use for command centers. I moved down the hall, Luger raised, Willie a few steps behind me, watching my back. I really can't explain our connection or why we work so well together, but when I'm with Willie, it's like we've been in the same commando unit for a dozen years. We don't need words. One acts, the other backs him up. As we moved down the hall, it sounded like Jesse was standing in front of us and screaming at the top of his lungs, not hidden behind some thick, closed door.
Y'all gonna kill me, bitch? You telling me who not to mess with? I'll mess with your girls anytime I want to. I just might wander over to your club and torch the place. What do you think of that?
We heard men laugh at Willie's remark. I didn't see the humor, but then again, I'm neither American nor stupid enough to work for Jesse Dupree. Slowly, silently, we moved halfway down the hall to only a few feet from the door that hid screaming Jesse. I was almost ready to reach for the handle when the door opened on its own. One of Jesse's guards started strolling out. I yanked the door the rest of the way open. The man stumbled forward. I moved past him, ignoring him. Even as I entered Jesse's office, I heard the telltale hiss of Willie's knife moving through the air, followed by a wet gurgle of fear, agony, and shock. I let my instincts guide me. Two men sat on either side of Jesse's big oak desk, smiles suddenly frozen on their faces. Dupree himself sat behind the desk, almost swallowed up by a big leather chair. It's amazing how much detail the eye can pick up and the brain can store in a momentarily life-and-death situation. The two guards wore black suits. One was blonde with a scar on the right side of his face, and the other had green eyes and a shock of orange hair. Jesse had the phone in his left hand, a half-empty bottle of Wild Turkey in his right hand, and a look of insolent anger plastered all over his face. I killed the guards in less than a second, bearing a silenced bullet in each of their foreheads. Their brains erupted out of the back of their heads like tomatoes squashed under a stormtrooper's boot. Gore splattered Jesse. His face instantly glowered wet red through the chunky mess. He never even flinched, I'll give him that. He never even looked scared. Just pissed. It actually looked kind of funny. The burst of laughter hit me so hard I couldn't even aim. Screaming without words, Jesse reached for something behind the desk.
I'm gonna kill you!
Blind Willie came flying into the room, jumped over the oak desk, and planted his knife firmly in Jesse Dupree's chest. Jesse let out a screech, but it wasn't fear, only pure anger. Much later, I had a chance to see the police report. Blind Willie stabbed him 16 times, but it was over with that first stroke. As he hacked away, I leaned over each of the dead men and kissed them on the lips. They were tender, loving kisses on lips that already grew cold. I picked up the phone, fully conscious of the irony.
Hello?
Who is this?
This is Zion Helmer.
I tried to form words through the peals of laughter. It was just so damn funny to see those guys with the back of their heads scattered all over the room. I composed myself long enough for one complete sentence.
The job is finished.
I hung up. Willie turned and quickly walked out of the room. We sprinted down the hall, onto the veranda, and down the rope. I barely managed to choke off my laughter as I descended. We could still see the guards' lazy work. Amazingly, we hadn't made enough noise to attract attention. I suppose that after years of working for Screaming Jesse Dupree, they were probably stone-cold deaf. We heard distant shouts of alarm as we silently cleared the estate wall and ran up the street. The night remained pitch black. We faded into nothingness. We stood next to Willie's car, both of us panting, trying to catch our breath in the cool night air.
Why you always kiss them boys, Fritz? I wish I knew.
I laughed so hard I had to put a hand on the hood to steady myself. Blind Willie just looked at me like I was crazy. I'm not crazy, of course. I just have an odd sense of humor.
I got him, right? You admit that, don't you, Fritz?
If I disagreed with him, he probably would have killed me on the spot. But I had no intention of arguing.
Yes, you got him. You killed Jesse Dupree. That's right. I did get him. I get the contract money all to myself.
There was a hint of malice in Willie's voice, but I didn't mind.
You got it, Willie. You got him.
I tried to look intimidated, but I'm not sure if I pulled it off. I could have crushed his throat with one swing. Not to mention, I still held a Luger, and he only had a knife in his hand. But this is America, after all, and you have to play the game. Why anyone would want to be known as Jesse Dupree's killer was beyond me. But I wasn't arguing. Word would get out that Blind Willie killed Jesse. No one would come looking for me. That's just the way I wanted it. Willie smiled, hopped into his car, and drove off. I walked to my car, keeping to the shadows and staying alert for any of Jesse's men, but I didn't see anyone. I drove home to clean up, then to Madame Sarah's to collect my money. Sure, Willie got $2,000 from the Jolson gang, but I got $4,000 from Madame Sarah. I was free and clear, while Willie got the rep for killing Jesse and all the troubles that would come with it. I should have felt bad for luring him into that situation, but hey, that's the way he wanted it. Americans, who can figure them out?
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.